lack of a plan to check it out. We just expect y'all to just rubber stamp.
Hey, good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. It's May 10th. And just a reminder, if folks can turn off your cell phones, that would be helpful. And today, just so folks know the schedule, we will be hearing House Bill 3601 first, and then we will do House Bill 3290, and then we will hear House Bill 2688 and House Bill 2129, and then last we'll have the informational meeting on the Willamette River Channel Maintenance. Senator Boquist is testifying in another committee, and he would like to come and speak about that, so we will do that towards the end. So with that, we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3601. And Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3601 would establish that the Department of State Lands and Department of Geology and Mineral Industries can enter into a memorandum of agreement in certain situations involving surface mining so that the sole responsibility for permitting is assigned to Doug Ammey. There is no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued.
We saw Louise Soliday sort of bolt out.
Here.
Okay. So I'd like to have the agencies. Rep. Schaffel, you want to come up since this is your bill? And then we'll have the agencies come up. Thank you. Okay. I have a feeling you have probably other places to go.
Many other places.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mike Schaffel, State Rep, House District 48, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland. This is passed out of House Business and Labor unanimously. Passed off the House floor 58-2. I think the Doug Ammey DSL entered into a memorandum of agreement in certain cases involving surface mining. All this does is streamline an already arduous process. It does not in any way amend, delete, water down, get rid of any water or environmental standards. It would default to Doug Ammey, but DSL would still have a veto. It's just a streamlining bill for a process, as you know, Madam Chair, that is difficult and rightfully so should be difficult to protect the beautiful nature and wonder of Oregon. But we need gravel in this state to build America. We're blessed with a lot of it, and I think we should mine it locally. We're reducing our carbon footprint and trucking and barging gravel, a rather cheap commodity, which once again we have an abundance of, so we can build America and put Americans back to work here in the great state of Oregon. I'd happily try to answer any questions you have. There's a bunch of experts behind me that will probably be a little more qualified than I am to answer
any
some
questions
of this.
For the good representative. Senator.
Absolutely. The glasses. Where are you getting your glasses?
You know what? Thank you for asking, Mr. Chair. I buy these at the kiosk when I forget mine.
No, they're very nice.
Yeah, thank you.
Color
very kind
ones.
Of you.
I just want to know.
I'm
well,
a slave
we could
to
see
fashion.
If we could arrange for Representative Schaffel to be your fashion consultant.
Yeah, that's right.
Just let the record note that.
Thank
any
you.
Other as legitimate questions?
I have a legitimate question.
What do you mean legitimate question?
Rep. Schaffel, this will streamline the system, make it easier for our businesses to do work in our state. Is that correct?
One would hope so, yes.
Excellent. That's
thank
all
you
I need.
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you, Representative, for coming here today. Actually, I'm going to have Rich Angstrom come up and because I think this bill was put in at the request of Dogami, that's my understanding, of OCAPA, and then we'll have Dogami and DSL come up. So, Rich, you want to talk about why you put this bill forward and why your folks think this is a good bill? We have visual aids.
Oh,
wow.
Oh my gosh, get out.
This is high tech.
Yeah. I guess so. I thought
back to junior high. The overhead projector.
Yeah, the overhead. Nice picture of that pen.
Yeah, I'll get that in a second. if I'm not smooth about that, it's I'm not the most technical person in the world.
I think there's some people in the room who have no idea what an overhead projector is. Okay.
So, my name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association, and I believe you all have some handouts that will be... You'll be able to follow along with your handouts of what I'll show you here, and then there's some extras for the audience. And then I'm going to basically walk through it a little bit with a couple of maps up here. But essentially what this bill does is it allows, impermissibly, allows DSL and Dogami to come to an agreement on areas where they have adjacent mingled jurisdiction. Reason for that, from our perspective, is if we didn't take this limited circumstance, we'd end up having to get two permits, one from DSL and one from Dogami. Traditionally, when it comes to mining activity, DSL has jurisdiction over bar scalping operations in the river and dredging operations and wetlands. Dogami has jurisdiction generally over floodplain mining. In fact, we built most of the floodplain mining expertise within Dogami. They have all the ologists you can possibly think of, the hydrologists, the geologists, the fluvial geomorphologists, and a biologist. And we've done that on purpose because floodplain mining is very intensive permitting process. So this circumstance comes up on a rare occasion where, by definitions of what waters of the state are and beds and banks, it's a very narrow situation where the waters of the state commingle jurisdictions with Dogami. And I want to show that through this diagram here. Let's start with this map. This is a nameless mine operation. And what you will see here is the Lamp River, and you'll see a side channel of the Willamette. And right here you'll see an old oxbow, but now it's pretty much a wetland. All right. So the river, as it comes up, and this is an 80 CFS flood, is so for jurisdiction normally, DSL would follow the ordinary high water mark, which comes along this line of the Willamette. But it's not always apparent where that line is. And by definition, when that's not the case, you go to the two-year flood event. So because there's a gap right in here, the waters will come in here, and they don't come into this mine site, proposed mine site, along this wall here. They actually come in way up in here. All right. So then what you end up having is, here's your upland, here's your flooded area. You end up with all these little islands of jurisdiction for Dogami, and then here's DSL's jurisdiction. And you end up with kind of a mess of who's on first base. And like I said, DSL usually has gravel bar scalping operations in here. They have dredging operations that might be in here. And then this is a wetland that floods out. And they have jurisdiction over wetlands. We're not changing any of that. All we're saying is for this, for Dogami and DSL to enter into an agreement that protects environmental issues, the waters of the state, where this particular upland flood boundary is normally in Dogami's jurisdiction.
Do we have a nameless county?
It's a nameless county. the county is Yamhill, I believe.
Okay.
So here's another diagram of this same site, and you have both of those. And then here's the Willamette. Here's this little wetland area. And you'll see on your map, now this is actually the two-year flood event. The other one was a CFS, an 80,000 CFS event. So it's actually a little higher, a little more flooding than this one. But you'll see you have these little fingers here and down in here in the mine site. These all create kind of a jurisdictional conundrum for the industry. And so what we're trying to accomplish in this bill is a little bit unique. And I want to say this for the policy issues on this, is I could have, as an industry, come in and said, we want to define what waters of the state are and ordinary high water and beds and banks. And we could have a big discussion over what the appropriate definitions of those are. But if we're going to focus on what the outcome is, which is to reduce the number of touches, both which benefits both the state and the industry, and maintain the environmental protections then there's a different way of doing that than sitting here and arguing over what the meanings of words are. Because what I've found in the legislative process is we can throw a lot of words at definitions, and some lawyer or some creative person is going to interpret those differently. And this is a different way of trying to legislate a solution that's outcome-based. It benefits us, it benefits, and it benefits the state, and we maintain those environmental efforts by allowing the two agencies to sit down and come to an agreement about how they're going to manage these very few sites like this. I think it's unique. I think it's important that we start looking at our regulatory environment a little bit different, and how we engage legislators and start trusting agencies to sit down and solve some of these problems instead of squabbling over the meaning of words like what waters of the state mean, what ordinary high water means, what beds and banks means. That's just tends to be a fruitless exercise, and nobody seems to come to agreement. People position themselves on those kinds of things. In this circumstance, what you'll get, and what we're all we're trying to do, is critically maintain those environmental protections. We're not reducing those at all, but reduce the number of touches that state agencies have in their permitting activity for sand and gravel operations.
So, Rich, I have a senator that wants to testify on an amendment, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to have the agencies come up and talk a little bit about how what the process is now. You don't have to go away.
Okay.
We can surround you with Dogami and DSL. We do need some lights. That would be helpful. And if I could have both Dogami and DSL come up here, because what I'd like to hear is how the process works now, and if this bill, the proposed language, went through, how that process would differ from the existing process, and how many sites we're talking about are affected by the statute, proposed statute. So whoever wants to go first, Rich, you can sit there right in the middle. We'll have you right between the two regulatory agencies. And then that's all that we have signed up, so we'll have Senator Bates come up after that. So why don't we have DSL go first, because it's under your current jurisdiction.
Okay, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Bill Ryan, Assistant Director of the Wetlands and Waterways Conservation Division of the Department of State Lands. And so to answer the question regarding the how business is done now, currently the jurisdictions between Dogami and DSL do not overlap, but they abut. And so basically the Department of State Lands has jurisdiction over activities that are within waters of the state, and that's defined as wetlands and waters below the ordinary high water line. And so, and then Dogami basically has jurisdiction of anything above that or excluded from that. And so, on a situation like the unnamed project in the unnamed county, in that circumstance, that particular operation basically would have operations that were in both DSL's and Dogami's jurisdiction. And so, the operator would need to get a removal field permit from DSL and a permit also from Dogami. And so, the number of projects that would be addressed on this is very very small. In fact, that's the only one right now that's active. So we're thinking probably one project, maybe a couple projects or permits a year that this would affect. And so the way that it currently works is that we do coordinate with Dogami to make sure that the terms and conditions that we're requiring are not, to protect the resources are not in conflict and basically are not creating a challenge for the applicants. However, the applicants do need to deal with both agencies and do need to get permits from both agencies. And so under this MOA, basically, we would still do that coordination to ensure the protections, but the applicant would only be dealing with the one agency, Dogami.
Okay, did you want to add something, and then we'll see if there's questions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and particularly I'm the Administrator for the Mine Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. We look at this, but the first thing I want to say, it doesn't change the fundamental issue, one of the fundamental issues here, which is the eligibility for parcel of land to be mined resides with the land use authority. They do the whether or not. DSL and Dogami do the how. So this is, we're talking about the how, and one of the things we're trying to do, and we have existing models that show that it works very well, is that we have MOAs with agencies to address what are difficult issues sometimes to deal with in terms of Mother Nature doesn't draw exact lines on the boundary where things are and where things aren't in terms of the in terms of our authority. So we think this is not in any way making the process less effective. It's only that we're making it better, and it's going to be better for everybody if we can agree on. And I'd kick it up a little and say this probably applies more to three or four sites of biennium than one. I mean, we have a couple coming on the books. But again, the unnamed site, as far as I know, doesn't even have land use approval yet. So so we think this is a good bill. Frankly, I've been here a long time, and I've never seen the state agencies work better. And I know that sometimes isn't a popular thing to say, but I do believe it. And this is a mechanism to help us make it even better yet. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the panel for these folks?
Yes.
Yes. Senator Olson.
Either Mr. Lynch or Mr. Ryan, are your application forms similar, alike, or a mirror image of each other, or do they ask the same questions?
Okay, thank you.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, they're not exactly the same, no. And we don't have that in Oregon yet, and some states have it. It's a huge investment to make to get into a position where all permits look alike. It sounds like it should be something easy, but it really isn't. But this is a step in that direction where we will work with the Department of State Lands as well as every other natural resource agency. I mean, we still work with every natural resource agency on any permit. It's reviewed by all.
Okay. Follow up. As far as any adjudication or any compliance efforts, who would handle that? Would it be Dugami?
Well, ultimately, it depends some degree on the violation. If for instance, they went into a wetland and mined a wetland, that would be illegal under DSL statutes. If they didn't salvage topsoil appropriately, that would be a Dugami issue. But that's the that's why we need to work together, is so that those things don't get hung up on interpretation or, you know, misunderstanding of what agency on the other. This puts us together, and I think that's what streamlining is about.
One follow-up.
Yeah. I have a question.
Mr. Angstrom, as far as these projects that are in the future, do you have or are there any opposition to this coordination? I mean, this is really precedent setting for the state. Is there any opposition to try to do something like this?
As I have talked with Sue Marshall and Jim Myron on it, and both of them I didn't have any issues with it. On the House side, the League of Women's Voters testified against the bill. And other than that, you know, it's been pretty well coordinated, discussed, you know, with the state agencies and our interests and others around our construction industries. And so, you know, that's kind of the lay of the land of where everybody's kind of positioned themselves.
Mm-hmm. Either for DSL or Dugami, would this be a cost savings to you guys? It would help your bottom line, in other words?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, minimal.
Okay.
I think if we do this directly, it saves a little money. But
okay.
We're not going to go to the bank on it.
All right. And for Department of State Lands, it wouldn't really be a cost savings. It'd be pretty much even.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Yeah.
So I just had a follow-up question, and I may need to follow up with DSL after this. So I just want to be clear. Would this then mean that an applicant that has a surface mine located upland from beds and banks and it only has to be part of it, does that mean they would not have to apply for a 404 permit?
Chair Dingfelder, no, it doesn't. The 404 permit is a federal, mm-hmm. you know, Clean Water Act permit, and so this would not affect that at all. It would still be subject to the 404 mm-hmm. permitting.
Just wanted to clarify. So, and the other question is, did you consider, I understand, since it's this mining operations, you're having Dugami be the sort of chief oversight. Was there discussion about having Department of State Lands be the chief oversight with consultation with Dugami? Any discussion about that?
Well, a little bit.
Arrangement.
The reason for that is the particular expertise of the two agencies. DSL's expertise is in dealing with bar scalping operations within the river, as I was showing, and then dredging operations there. And that's where their staff's expertise is. And with Dogami, their expertise is doing the floodplain mines. Well, I should say also DSL's expertise is wetlands. It's probably the most critical function there. And so we'd still have to get any wetland impact to wetlands. We'd still get the wetlands permit from DSL. But with the complexity of floodplain mines, there's a reason. Many of you are sitting on the Ways and Means, so you know this. Looking at the MLR program, is Dogami has the fluvial geomorphologist, which is a sediment transport person, and they look at river capture issues of these sites. We have a biologist to look at species capture issues. We have a reclamationist to help turn it back into some public use and or farmland. They have a groundwater hydrologist to make sure there's no impacts on groundwater for these sites. Those are unique specialties that are required in permitting a floodplain, and those expertises don't reside in DSL, as far as I know, at least collected like that and focused on floodplain mining. So it makes sense for Dogami in this circumstance to be the chief, the chief permitter. If we were talking about the in-water activity, it would make sense it would be the other way around, because that expertise goes that way.
Any other questions? Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Senator Bates. Senator Bates had an amendment related to mining and wanted to discuss it with the committee, because this is something that we'll probably be dealing with at some time. And so it seemed like a good time to pull Senator Bates out of his other committee.
This is much more interesting.
Yeah. We always have cutting-edge issues here. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Alan Bates, District 3, Southern Oregon. And I want to thank you for taking some time to listen to me this afternoon. It'll only take a few minutes, but I want to sort of tease something up that we hope to be looking at in February or the next session, hopefully in February.
And, Senator, I just wanted to make sure folks knew that you had an amendment that would have fit within this relating clause, but that's the reason that you're here. And what we had talked about was having you talk about the amendment, but looking at some possibly a work group or something during the interim.
Yeah,
so if folks are wondering why... How this is related to the bill in front of you.
The relating clause was appropriate for this. And I want to describe the problem first. It's in Southern Oregon. It may spread a bit to the rest of the state, and some things we're thinking about to fix the problem. The problem is this. We have rivers in Southern Oregon that actually have gold in them. And you can go out and pan for that gold, or you can use dredge mining to get that gold out. Dredge mining is a process where you usually have a small motor, a gas motor, sitting on a floating platform, and you have a suction that goes down into the river. You suck up gravel, and that dredges it up, and the gravel is then run through the dredge, and you actually get gold out of that. And just to be perfectly honest, I've got friends who love to fish in these areas, and I've got friends who love to dredge in those areas. And I got friends that like to do both in those areas. They dredge part of the year and they fish part of the year. The problem is that about a year and a half, 2 years ago, Southern Oregon was inundated with a huge number of dredgers. The reason was California put a temporary embargo on any dredging in their streams because they were worried about the effect on salmon and steelhead runs. As a result, we had a huge number of people coming in from California to dredge in our streams. If you look at the various states around us that allow dredging, you'll find 40, 50, 60, 70 people having licenses do that, in some states as high as 100. And then you come to Oregon, we have over 1,000. That's a sudden change for us. It's led to some real serious problems. Fishermen and recreationalists are getting in contact with dredgers. There's some conflict starting to build there. We're getting complaints from people who live along the river saying the first thing, the crack of dawn, they hear an engine go on, it runs all day long and disrupting their enjoyment of the river due to the noise and the dredging that's happening in front of their homes or near their homes. And there's a real concern, which California is studying for us, about how this affects salmon steelhead reds. In other words, where these salmon steelhead lay their eggs. California is completing that study now, so we'll finally have for the first time some good data about how important those areas are or are not as far as our salmon steelhead runs are concerned. The state has mapped out that in our streams, about 20% of those streams are what we call essential salmon habitat waters, salmonoids being both steelhead and salmon. And the other 80% of the streams is felt are not that important other than for passage of the fish and not important as far as actual rearing of salmon and, more importantly, where they spawn at. This bill, the dash ones we offered, asked that those 20% of those streams be put off limits for dredging. It asked that within 500 feet of water intakes, in other words, where people bring water in out of rivers, which essentially where most of them live, there'd be no dredging. And that we base it hopefully on some solid scientific evidence, which we did not receive yet from California. We want to see what the real impact of dredging has been before we go forward with any policy. In addition, since the fees charged for people dredging and the ability to make sure they're dredging properly and under proper areas is essentially not present, the fee is extremely low, we thought we would tie this to the cost of fishing for salmon steelhead. So we thought it would be kind of innovative to say your dredging fee is the same as buying a fishing license in Oregon and the same as you have for your steelhead and salmon tags. And that money would go into a fund to regulate and watch that the dredging is done properly. I just think it's not yet appropriate to bring this dash ones forward. We need to put together a work group of dredgers, people who care about salmon and steelhead, people who live along the rivers, bring them together and see if we can find some common ground. Now, whether that can be done or not, I do not know. People get pretty upset about this stuff. The fishermen get really excited about it. The dredgers get really excited about it, and it can lead almost to armed conflicts. In fact, I'm afraid it could lead to that someday if this isn't dealt with. We recently had in Josephine County an issue in which a group of individuals who were mountain bikers went across a piece of property that was a mining site, a personal mining site for one person, and we had a shooting as a result of that. Someone got shot and really seriously hurt, lost their arm. And that kind of stuff is something that does happen when people have high emotions about these kinds of issues. We don't want that to start happening in our rivers. We don't want this kind of conflict going on. I think there's some common ground here. We need to find that common ground, and we're going to try to put a work group together in February and see if we can find some common ground that we all can agree to and bring forward some dash ones for you next time around that would be for your consideration.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Any questions for the Senator? Your house.
Thank you. I just very much applaud your effort in doing this and your restraint in doing it the right way, making sure we have something that would, you know, have some data on which there's no argument.
Thank you, Senator Hass. Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. I don't like public fist fights. No one wins, and we need to find something that will work for everybody here. I think we have a chance to do that. No guarantees, but a chance to do that.
Great. Well, we appreciate your hard work on this, and we will look forward, I'm sure, to hearing from you more after the work group or some updates during the work group and hopefully with some legislation next session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tell you, your committees are a lot more interesting than the ones I'm sitting on. I love this stuff. I used to chair natural resources. A lot more fun than being down in the budget committees. So thank you. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 3601? Can they come on up? Anybody else? Okay.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall, representing Tualatin Riverkeepers and Willamette Riverkeeper. I wasn't intending to testify, but since my name was mentioned, I thought I'd pop up here. The Riverkeepers haven't taken a position on this bill. We were initially concerned if we thought it might impact 404 permitting, but as it doesn't, then that's a relief to us. But we haven't taken a position, although we would very much support Senator Bates' Dash 1 amendment or the... and or the task force that might be moving forwards, and appreciate his work on that. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Sue? All right, Sue, thank you very much. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3601, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3290. Beth?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3290 would modify the application of the farm income standard that's adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission for establishing primary and accessory dwellings in conjunction with farm use in areas zoned for exclusive farm use. Both minimal revenue and fiscal impacts, so no statements were issued.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Thompson. Sorry to keep you waiting. We appreciate your patience.
That's quite all right. very gratifying to sit in the audience.
I'm just enjoying the view of a committee that doesn't have co-chairs, so it's so straightforward, you know.
The chair appreciates that as well.
I'll bet you do. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Thompson. I'm a state representative for House District 23, which is a large rural district in West Willamette Valley and south of Salem. So I have a lot of these small farms. In order for a farmer to build a home on EFU farm property, they have two options under LCDC rules. They have to have a farm income of $80,000 in each of the past 2 years, or they have to have $80,000 in income in 3 of the past 5 years. House Bill 3290 adds a third option. This provides the option to average income from the farm for 3 of the past 5 years. This third option to average evens out the variation in farm production and or crop pricing to take into account the vagaries of weather and agricultural markets. At the rate the weather is going this spring, this may be one of those years if the cherry crop doesn't perk up here. This affects a very few small farmers who hover just above or below the $80,000 mark year after year. Farmer who makes $85,000 for 2 years, then falls to $78,000 in the third year, would be helped by this legislation. It passed unanimously out of the House committee and unanimously off the floor of the House, so I'm hoping you will give it due consideration in the Senate. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to a constituent who's affected by the bill and can probably give you more information than I have.
Thank you. Any questions for the representatives?
Okay. I'll excuse myself to another committee then.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you
for coming here to testify today. Hi there. Can you state your name for the record, please?
Thanks for hearing me, Madam Chairman and Committee. I am Pat Wildman. My address is at this point Salem, Oregon, and I have been in Oregon since 71. We have a farm on the entrance, the main entrance into Dallas. I'm a Kansas farm girl, so I have a really hard, we're right on the transition line, and I have a really hard time putting houses on this Class 1, Class 2 soil. We are trying very hard to up the productivity so that it has an income that will work and not lose money on it. Losing money it won't last very long. Averaging 3 out of 5 years would qualify us at this point. We have 1,300 cherry trees, 1,100 blueberry bushes. We've added blackberries, raspberries, the local honey. We have the bees in the orchard. We have set up a fruit stand. Last summer, we doubled business over the year before. The town really seems to appreciate us. I would much rather take this and keep it as a farm. We cannot put free-range chickens on this farm without being there. I would not put any animal out there by itself. You just need to be there. The acreage is 23 acres. It's sitting right on the transition line of Dallas. We've owned it for over 27 years. The regulations originally were not what they are today, what the Congress here put into place was something we could work with, but the departments that are over that, and I'm not, my verbal isn't so great, but the people that are over that have changed those rules, and we're just having a really hard time fitting because cherries are very volatile as far as price. Last year they dropped the price of cherries a nickel a pound, and in addition to that, we have several varieties of cherries, and the first variety was taken out because of the wet spring. Some years we'll have over 80, you know, we'll have a lot. We'll have 120,000, and yet On the other hand, we might have a lot less and not qualify. So I would really appreciate this. We travel two vehicles because we're both doing different, my husband and I are doing different things, 30 minutes each way. This would put us on the farm and not in a house just next door. A house next door will, there won't be any chickens on the farm because that's just not, that just doesn't work. We do need to be there or have somebody there 24/7 when you have the productivity on a farm like this. The city of Dallas is very appreciative of our fruit stand. The business is growing. I get calls all winter long. Do you have local honey? And so it's pretty exciting to us. I just like to take this on further, and I'm not sure how we're going to be able to financially do it if we can't get a house there. In addition to that, I have a letter from my daughter, who's my grandson, has worked for us the last 2 years. Of course, grandmas are prejudiced, but anyway. Mm-hmm. I have a vested interest in this bill since I am part of a family-owned farm in Dallas, Oregon. There's a desire among the family to improve this farm, and changes have been made to increase farm productivity for current need. We are wanting to place animals such as free-range chickens on the farm, but they need constant attention. Also, unless this bill is passed, family members will continue to drive a great distance just to manage the farm. With the price of fuel this summer, it's going to be astronomical. Please move 3290 to the floor. It will be greatly appreciated. The farm is in a great location for the local community to purchase products that are produced on this farm, and this will in turn increase the revenue for the state of Oregon. Please help the community by moving 3290 to the floor. I won't read it to you, but I have a very nice letter from Lynette and Gene Henshaw from Dallas in their appreciation for the fruit stand. And I also have a letter from Travis Sobalski, and he says, I'm contacting you to ask that you move 3290 to the floor. I'm asking you to do so because this bill will help small farms become more profitable and sustainable. It will give these farms the ability to raise free-range chickens, organic beef, and other things which require constant attention from farmers.
If you could submit those,
I didn't have enough copies of this one.
Okay, well,
but it's very brief. He says it will improve the state of Oregon's income, and then
if you have any others, you can just submit it, or we'll make copies before you go, and then we can have it for the record.
So. Okay, and that one thing I'd like to add is the word averaging is very understandable for me as a farmer.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Wildman? All right. Thank you for coming here today.
Thanks.
Really appreciate it. And
thanks for hearing me.
If you want to drop it off to Erica, we can make a copy and make sure you get that back.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And we have a couple more folks that would like to testify. Stephen Kafori. And I'm going to call up, I'll have you all come up. Lon Sweeney. Lon here. And
Carla Kay
Edwards. You all come up. Why don't you go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We're supportive of the bill. We have some concerns about the language. We think that we want to make sure that the language is technically correct so that it doesn't add anything or detract anything from the bill and that it fits in with the existing LCDC rules. I've talked to Representative Thompson about this just now. I apologize to the legislature as a whole that we didn't have this prepared for the House action, but as you know, there's been a lot of land use bills, and I'm just one person trying to keep in touch with them, and we just got this now. So I sent an email to the chair with our proposed amendments. I will give this now here. They should be non-controversial. They should be something that would help the bill pass, and once it passes, ensure that it means what it says.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Stephen? Okay. All right, thanks. Whoever wants to go next?
Hi, my name is Lon Sweeney,
and apologize. It's the first time I've testified before a Senate committee, so I'll
try not to ask you too many questions.
Yeah. Just hit softly. I originally wasn't going to come down and bother you folks, but I saw legislation where you passed a bill that would allow restaurants in an EFU zone. So I thought that maybe you might want to hear my idea about how to get a home in an EFU zone. And
okay, we have this. I'm just going to mention if you could just summarize your testimony.
That's over here. I got.
Okay, just want to make sure you're not going to read this because we do have lots of other bills.
I don't want to put everybody to sleep.
Yeah.
Okay, so the language is right here.
Okay.
Is that good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what brought this all up was I bought 77 acres of land in Jefferson County. 70 of it's tillable, 7 is scab land, rocks, non-irrigable. I can't do anything with that 7 acres. Prior to buying that land, I went to the Jefferson County Development Commission, and they told me I would only have to produce $40,000 on that land for 2 years before the state would allow me to build a home on my farm. 1 year after I bought the farm, the county said, oops, that land's irrigated. You're going to have to gross $80,000. By the way, my neighbor and I went together and put in a center pivot so we could cut back on water usage. And the way the land was shaped, the other farmers didn't want it because they couldn't make a center pivot. But this neighbor and I kind of hit it off, and we got it going now. Anyway, that $80,000 hit initiated my 7-year research into the $80,000 rule. And I found that 84.9% of all farms in Oregon today gross less than $50,000. I tracked back and found the Technical Review Committee report, that's the committee that came up with the idea of the $80,000 rule. One of the persons on that committee stated that a farmer could easily gross $40,000 on 10 acres. That's just not logical. That doesn't meet, statewide it doesn't fly. That same member did not like one of the rules because it encouraged the creation of agriculture instead of recognizing existing agriculture. And that's in the minutes. The 80,000 rule was put there to block new folks from getting into farming. It protects existing farmers, and it does not protect the land. It was about land use. I know in 1975, when I got out of the service, I came home and got on Gresham's Land Use Planning Committee. It was when they first started getting this together. And I thought, this is a great idea. Because around Gresham, there was berries and all kinds of good stuff. And I wanted to protect it. I had no idea that it was going to come to this, where you get this $80,000 rule that would not allow a person to put a house on their farm. In my written testimony, I have provided evidence that graphically shows the inequity of the $80,000 rule when it applies to eastern and central Oregon, particularly with the soils. I've also pointed out the discrepancies between the Natural Resources Conservation Service report that LCDC used to define prime soils and what is actually grown and harvested on that land. The $80,000 rule, at best, is arbitrary, capricious, and punitive in nature. It should be done away with. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. You did really well. And since this is Senator Thompson's constituent, I don't know if you wanted to say from Sandy. Say a few words. I think you had said you wanted to say a few words.
Yeah, we talked out in the hallway, and I know this as a pear grower. I know this it's tough to hit that. And as any kind of farmer, it's almost impossible to hit the same amount every year. It's all due to the weather. You can't predict and you can't fight Mother Nature. A lot of years you go with what you got, and then the year that you have a really big crop, the prices are down because everybody's got a big crop. So it's a tough standard. I really believe averaging works real well. I know it won't open the floodgates. I think it would like possibly the lady that was here at first, the people that are right around the 75,000 each year. Maybe they jump up to 90 one year and back to 75. It's those people that this might affect. I really don't think it'll be that much, because that's 80,000 standard. It's a pretty high standard. And if you're working your a farm away from your house, it's very difficult to do that and be in control of unforeseen circumstances like animals,
irrigation pumps.
Pumps, water. I mean, you have to be there in order to do an effective job, and this would allow some of the. We have a big influx, I think, of kind of new family farmers that are interested in farming and doing things like we talked about the poultry folks, and then we've got another bill in here with some more family farmers that are interested in, and it's tough to do that if you don't live on your land. So,
thank you, Senator.
You bet.
And Carla, do you want to say a few words, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Great. Thanks. Thank you this afternoon for having this opportunity. I'm Carla K. Edwards. I'm with the Cascade Policy Institute, and I'm actually their rural policy analyst. We support 3290, but this does not go far enough to actually address an issue that is probably the biggest issue that I have seen throughout Oregon and has been brought up to me throughout Oregon on land use issues. An income test was never a good predictor of commercial viability. Significant change has happened in what agriculture is today since the adoption of this rule in 1994, where our wine industry was in its infancy and farm markets were in their infancy, and CSAs basically didn't even exist in 1994, where there's a real opportunity and viability for folks with small acreages to actually have commercial agriculture without having to be lease it to other farmers to farm it. The hurdle is they can't live there, and that's very difficult for small farmers, who often have to maintain a full-time job of employment and attempt to try to farm a piece of property that they do not live on. It makes it very difficult. This $80,000 rule standard isn't based upon how many acres you have. We all know that when Senate Bill 100 went in, not all acreage is 80 acres or greater. There are a number of 23-acre fields out there that still have to meet that $80,000 income rule standard. This does not in any way protect commercial agriculture, of which it was originally intended to do, but it truly isn't. Our agricultural system has changed here. It is viable here to be a small farmer and have a full-time job and still be very productive in farmers markets, but you're not going to be allowed to live on your property if you do it. Many lots remain by default in green space that actually could be in commercial production, but they aren't because a person cannot live on their property. And in those small acreages, often they are intensive, like vegetables and fruits that should be grown there to make it economically viable. Those take a lot of man hours and a lot of time, but it's not practicable if you can't live there. So there's a lot of small acreages that essentially are green space that are doing nothing to help the agricultural income and industry out there that could actually be productive agricultural land. I recommend allowing that. Or we would hope that you would bring this up as an issue if you don't choose to amend it today and move this just as it is. This is an issue that has to be addressed. LCDC doesn't want to address it. It's time for the legislature to take it up and to talk about, does this rule fit what the industry is today? We recommend allowing a primary residence dwelling to be established without an income test. Once you've established a primary dwelling, if you want to put on an income test for additional dwellings, that's something that should be decided. But just to allow a primary dwelling by default on a piece of property is not going to create a flurry of building out and rural property. And, in fact, it may actually increase commercial viability and agricultural output for this state. We believe this is viable and will allow folks to put property that could be in farm and agriculture actually into production and actually be a mainstay for the small farm movement that is moving through this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Edwards. Any questions for either of these witnesses?
No.
Okay. Great. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Nice talking, folks.
Thank you very much for coming here today. And with that, anybody else like to testify in House Bill 3290? Okay. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3290. We'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2688. Carmel Charlotte. Charlotte, come up. And Beth, can you provide us with an overview, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2688A would clarify the provisions governing designation of urban reserves incorporated into a particular statute or applicable to cities less than 2,500. It would also clarify the provisions incorporated into an additional statute, which is identified in the staff measure summary, are applicable to urban reserve designations made by cities of 2,500 or more. It also corrects a cross-reference between two statutes, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. And this is brought to us by the Oregon State Park Real Estate mm-hmm. Section. Okay.
Good afternoon, sure. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Carmel Bender Charland. I've been an attorney in Oregon since 2002, and I'm here as a member of the Oregon State Bar's Real Estate and Land Use Section to testify in favor of House Bill 2688. Our section proposed House Bill 2688 in order to correct a statutory reference that was inadvertently not updated when ORS 197.626 was enacted. Currently, ORS 195.145 sub 1 sub A allows local governments to designate land for urban reserves subject to the post-acknowledgement procedures set out in ORS 197.6102.625. This process is a local land use decision that is appealable to LUBA. However, 197.626 establishes a different process for designating urban reserves for cities with a population of 2,500 or more. The periodic review process found in ORS 197.628-650, which is reviewed by LCDC. So a direct conflict is created in the statutes as to how a decision to designate urban reserves is reviewed. So House Bill 2688 amends ORS 195.145 so that it correctly includes a reference to ORS 197.626, acknowledging the different processes for designating urban reserves depending on the size of the city. It also amends ORS 197.626 to properly cross-reference the affected provisions in ORS 195.145. There was an amendment to the bill in the House, which all parties agreed to. The Department of Land Conservation and Development raised concerns that, as previously worded, the bill could have been interpreted to eliminate certain notice requirements when adopting urban reserves. That was not the intention, and the bill was amended to resolve this issue. So I urge the Judiciary Committee – no, this is not the Judiciary Committee.
this Normally. Committee.
Yeah. You got two members here, but
– close enough. I urge the committee to adopt the amendment and to adopt the bill and move to the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sherlin. I did hear about the concern in the House, so I was glad to see that that was amended.
Yeah.
Any questions? Okay. Great. Thanks. That was easy. Anybody else like to testify in House Bill 2688? It should be A, shouldn't it? It is. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2688A. I will entertain a motion if folks are okay with that for a work session. Okay, I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2688A. Do you want to make a motion?
Sure.
Okay.
I move that House Bill 2688A be moved to the floor for
the
due pass recommendation. That's right. I knew there was something in there.
Senator Olson moves House Bill 2688A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll, please.
I don't need that. You put me up first.
Aye.
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 Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Senator Olson?
Aye.
Senator Aye. We get everybody? Okay. With that, the motion carries, and Senator Przanski, since this could have gone to the Judiciary Committee and you're a resident attorney, would you like to carry this?
I'd be glad to.
Okay. Thank you. With that, work session is closed on House Bill 2688A. We will open up a public hearing. Ooh, on House Bill 2129. Beth?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2129A would modify the process for local governments to make changes to the acknowledged comprehensive plan or land use regulation, primarily with respect to the notice requirements associated with such amendments. There was a minimal fiscal impact, so no statement was issued and no revenue impact.
Okay, we have Peggy Lynch. I'd like to come up and, well, Rob, you want to come up first from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, Halliburton, and then Peggy was the only person who had signed up. You can come up next. Hey, Rob, thank you.
Madam Chair,
so
members of the committee.
Tell us why we need this bill.
Okay. My name is Rob Halliburton. I'm Planning Services Manager for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Thank you for having me today. This is a DLCD bill. One of LCDC's primary responsibilities is to ensure that city and county comprehensive land use plans conform to the statewide planning goals, and they do this through a process called acknowledgement. A local government then goes about updating its plan, its acknowledged plan and zoning ordinances as they find needs, and these changes are generally not subject to LCDC or DLCD approval, but they do get submitted to the department through a process known as a post-acknowledgement plan amendment, and we call these PAPAs. Post-acknowledgement plan amendment is a bit of a mouthful. If I fall into some jargon, you'll know what I'm talking about there. Local government is required to send notice of proposed and adopted plan amendments to DLCD through this post-acknowledgement plan amendment process so that the department can in turn provide notice to interested parties and that the department can decide whether to participate in the local hearing itself. A final local decision on a post-acknowledgement plan amendment gets appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals, which I'm sure you're familiar with LUBA. So the statute includes procedural requirements for local governments on how and when to submit their proposed amendments and adopted amendments. And the statute also includes requirements for DLCD on how and when to send comments and when to send the notices that we're required to send. And local government failure to follow the procedures in the statute can result in the decision being remanded should the decision be appealed to LUBA. So the notice process that's in the statute hasn't been updated in many years. Legal decisions have interpreted the statutory requirements in ways that are not well known by many local governments, and it's resulted in a process that's not particularly transparent, and local governments sometimes can inadvertently fall into procedural traps that end up in remands when they weren't really trying to do anything wrong. So House Bill 2129 makes primarily technical adjustments to clarify and modernize the statute to reduce costs, prevent unreasonable delays, and make sure notices reach the intended audience with the proper content and at the right time. That's really the overriding purpose of the bill. Updates that it makes is it clarifies what happens when a city or county makes a substantial change to a proposal late in the local process. That's been sort of one area of ongoing litigation, is the notice requirements when something transforms as it moves through the hearings process. So we've tried to make that more clear and transparent. And it also allows amendments to conform local codes to new legislation without having a hearing. There was a pilot I forget the number of the bill, from 2009, that allowed counties to do this, and it worked quite well, and we're proposing to have it go statewide on any local code just to conform it to something this body requires the local government to do. So that really is my quick summary of the bill, and I will entertain any questions, and we recommend the committee recommend it do pass.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for the department? Yeah, I'm assuming you worked with the Oregon Planners Association and League of Oregon Counties and
yes, we included yes. local governments in
yeah,
yes
in this, and I didn't see that anyone. As a matter of fact, there was a couple of no votes over in the House, which will be interesting to find out why they voted no, but there were 57 votes in support. Was there any concern about? Sounds like to me this is somewhat of a streamlining.
That is certainly the intent.
Yeah.
And there was discussion on the particulars and the wording of the bill. But I believe we were all in alignment with local government all along on the intent.
Okay. Well, I think we have the League of Women Voters that would like to come up and speak on this, so we'll hear her comments. And why don't you stick around in case we have any questions?
Okay.
You sure? Peggy, you want to come up? Why don't you stay up here in case there's any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Legal Women Voters of Oregon. Actually, I want to clarify before I start saying good bill should pass, but I do want to bring a concern before you simply because I think it's a really important concern that you should be aware of. And the League has brought this concern to the Department and to the House simply as a red flag because we have to find a solution. I don't see that solution happening in this bill, but we do need to find a solution. During the development of this legislative concept, the League expressed a concern that Section 6 allows a local government to amend a comprehensive plan or development code without a public hearing if the change simply updates the local documents to conform to land use statutes, statewide goal, or rule. In other words, the work that you do here, this bill would allow local governments to go ahead and place the new laws into their comp plans or development codes without a local public hearing. Now, we've seen the frustration of citizens who participate in a local hearing only to be told by the jurisdiction that they had no choice but to implement this state law or rule because it was done by the legislature and we're simply following what they told us to do. But we are concerned that that this reduces the opportunity for public education of changes in land use law. That public hearing provides notice to citizens of the changes in land use law that they may miss during these legislative sessions or LCDC meetings. And in 1998, Oregon citizens passed ballot measure 56, now ORS 197-047. However, the notices required by that initiative have lost their impact to local citizens because, frankly, they're relatively unclear. They simply say some action may happen that may affect your property, but it isn't always really clear exactly what that action might be. If we don't figure out a way to address the issue of assuring that local citizens understand and are informed of general laws passed that may affect their property by this body or LCDC, we will see more initiatives that may not be in the best interests of Oregon, and that's our concern. Somehow or another, we have to bolster the public education process related to land use changes in land use law. Thank you for listening.
So I have a question for the department. Was that issue discussed? Because I'm looking at that section, and I understand it has to be, it sounds like it has to be subsection A and subsection B in order for that to go into effect. But if you have any comments on that, I think it would be helpful.
Madam Chair, you're going to force me to admit that I'm a vacation fill-in here today.
Okay.
The bill was primarily drafted and amended by Richard Whitman, who's not with the department anymore, and then
we know where to find him, so we'll talk to him.
So the answer to the question, Madam Chair, is frankly, yes, I brought this up at LCDC and DLCD meetings when they were developing this concept, and I did bring it before the House. I don't see a way of amending this bill, frankly, to take care of it. It is a dual problem. It's a problem that if citizens show up at a local land use hearing, and they have a public hearing, and yet all the local government is doing is implementing a law that you told them to implement. It's frustrating for them to be told, we don't like this law, and yet the county or city has to say, well, you know, talk to your legislator about that. So I know there's both two sides of this coin. And this is a streamlining. It does mean that they don't have to have the two public hearings and go through their total process. But somehow or another, we have to figure out a better way to educate Oregonians when we do change their laws or laws related to their lands.
Thank you for bringing that issue up.
Sure.
And I'll be talking to former Director Whitman about that. Other questions, Senator Thompson? Did you want to make a comment or you had a question?
I've been at the county level, and that's absolutely true.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? I think we're just going to do the public hearing on this.
Okay.
And so, yes, Linda, come on up. Colleagues, we're not going to hold a work session because I would like to speak to Richard Whitman about this.
Linda? For the record, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. We do support the version, Angros version of House Bill 2129. We had some concerns early on and worked with the department to get through those concerns. But what I wanted to say in the record, that portion that you see that Ms. Lynch was testifying about, it's permissive language in here. Local governments, if they are trying to conform their land use plans, their comprehensive plans with a new state regulation, may go through that process without a hearing. When we ran this provision through our membership, we had many cities say, that's very nice, thank you, that we appreciate that being in statute. However, we probably will go through our normal, regular process. So this doesn't say cities or counties have to conform this way. They still have the ability to go through their normal hearing routes.
That's helpful.
Notice.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Any questions for the league? All right, thank you for that clarification. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2129A, and we will hold up in the work session. Would like to just follow up with Richard Whitman, and we have a member that had to step out, so we'll wait for that work session. So with that, we are done with the bills on our agenda, but we have an informational meeting on the Willamette River Channel Maintenance, and I still don't see Senator Boquist here yet.
Nope.
Yeah, but we will get started, and do we have a list of folks?
No, I don't.
Okay, so I know all of you want to testify, whoever wants to come up first. And yes, and former Representative Liz Van Leeuwen, you want to come up and introduce?
Liz?
Do you want to come up and
introduce?
Yeah.
Great. As former representatives, you can introduce who you have with you.
Right, that would be great, and good to see you, and thank you for coming.
Yes. For the record, I'm former State Representative Liz Van Leeuwen, and currently I am the elected to Lynn Soil and Water Conservation District, which is the home agency for the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group, which is addressed in Senate Bill 501.
And I should just, let me just say, we also have Representative would like to come up, but I'm just going to officially open up an informational meeting for folks that are listening in on the Willamette River Channel maintenance issue. I've, in the past, I think I've been at several hearings over the past years on this, and Senator Boquist had asked to have this informational hearing to educate our committee members about the issue, and so appreciate you coming here. Sorry to interrupt. And
no, that's fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
You got a large committee today, so almost looks like our health care committee at 3 o'clock Friday afternoon. So, for the record, I'm State Representative Jim Widener, represent most of Yamhill County and some of Polk County. Want to thank the members of the Senate Committee on Environmental and Natural Resources for hearing this bill today. I want to thank those who are here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 501 and encourage us to look into these options that can bring prosperity back to Oregon. I have constituents who are looking at massive losses of farmland due to large land grabs by aggregate companies who need gravel for construction and rebuilding Oregon's economy. Oregon's farmland sustains a rich and traditional of agriculture and is an integral part into the food network of Oregon for local communities and food export, and increases tourism to Oregon through the foodie movement, which is a highly marketed as fresh, healthy, sustainable. Working with the rivers combines these efforts and allows for both aggregate companies and farmers to proceed in doing their part to restore Oregon's economy. This is just to highlight a couple of benefits to Oregon, and the following speakers will go into it further in detail with above mentioned and more. Thank you for your time, considerations of Senate Bill 501, and they will tell you some of the issues that we're facing with the Willamette River in the district. It actually brings a lot of tourism into our area from the metropolitan area, and Deputy Warden over here, Sergeant Warden, will be testifying to that and the issues that they face on the river with a lot of the boating and recreation that goes on. And Commissioner George over here will be testifying on a lot of benefits that we get from the river in our district as well. So, with
Senator?
That.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just for the record, just because this is going out to everyone, I know how, let's say, rumors start. I just want to clarify, there's not a Senate Bill 501. I mean, there was, but this is not a hearing on Senate Bill 501. This is an informational hearing on the context and the within 501. So people who are listening don't think that we're actually working on Senate bills after the deadline was over.
That wouldn't work for me. I just kind of came into it. Well, I actually was walking through the upstairs and saw Senator Boquist talking to my constituents and found out what was going on.
We just want to be clear, the deadline for Senate bills is over, so we don't want the Senate president running down here thinking we're doing something against the rules. So Senator Boquist asked if we would have an informational hearing on this issue. So that's,
I would love to see the Senate president come join us for this as well. So
great.
With that, I will turn it over to my constituents.
Great. Thank you. Where would like to go next? And just if you can state your name for the record, please.
Okay, my name is Kathy George. I'm a Yamhill County Commissioner, and I want to thank you for holding this informational hearing and listen to our testimony. You will be hearing testimony from Yamhill County's Marine Patrol Sergeant, Sergeant Warden, and while I strongly support what he has to say, I will not repeat what he has to say except to reinforce my concerns for the safety of both our deputies and our river-using public. As a county commissioner with a county that borders the Willamette River, I participate in quasi-judicial land use hearings. A few years ago, during an application for gravel mining, I realized that areas in the Willamette River were filling up with gravel while we were receiving applications to approve prime river silt farmland for gravel extraction. From maps provided in various land use hearings, I also became aware of a particular situation at Lambert Bend that further threatens prime farmland. We worked on this for several years. Over the past 30 to 40 years, the river has deposited a mountain of gravel in the river's curve at the beginning of the bend that is forcing the river to cut across the bend during high water times. The river will eventually consume the bend, and when that happens, even more farmland is going to go underwater during the winter water levels. Although a number of representatives from the state, federal, and local governments, several local landowners and farmers worked on this problem, the restrictions proved insurmountable. This seems like a waste of prime farmland when an easy solution would be to mine the gravel from the river deposits and leave the farmland intact. These restrictions against gravel removal needlessly pit users of necessary natural resources against one another. As a commissioner, we also share responsibility with Marion County for the maintenance of the Wheatland Ferry. During certain periods of the year, the gravel deposits prevent the ferry from running across the river. When Marion County clears the pathway of the ferry, they have to remove the gravel and temporarily place it on a barge. Then they have to move it downstream and place the dredged gravel back into the river. This is time-consuming. It's expensive, and especially when the river continually replaces the gravel deposits all by itself. The counties could actually help pay for the maintenance by selling the gravel or using it in road and bridge projects. There are a number of gravel businesses along the Willamette River. If the river channel were maintained, the gravel could be barged from the mines to the gravel company facilities. This would minimize road and bridge wear and tear, and it would help relieve traffic congestion to the cities. However, the shallowness of the river channel during much of the year makes river commerce unlikely to happen unless maintenance efforts are allowed. Shallow river causes water temperatures to rise and produces a poor habitat for the fish. So I urge you to work on this bill. I realize it's not a bill now, but I would urge you to seriously consider helping us to modify whatever rules it is that are prohibiting normal, safe maintenance of the river so that we can provide safer use, productive use, and reasonable historic commerce on the river. And I want to thank you again very much.
Great. Thank you for coming here today. Sure.
My name is Steve Warden. I'm a sergeant with Yamhill County Sheriff's Office. Thanks for having me here. I'm not going to read through what I prepared for you, but I'll hit on a few bullet points. I manage the marine program in Yamhill County, and I work closely with Polk County and their marine patrol program. We've got in our patrol area four areas in the river where the water gets shallow in the summertime to the point that we can't pass at times with our patrol boats. We've encountered issues where people have grounded their boats. There's been accidents. We've had drownings, and it's important that between us and Newburgh Fire Department's water rescue that we can respond into these areas and reach these boaters safely. Last year at Dorsey Landing area, it's a popular swimming area that on periods when there's very low water, we have a difficult time reaching it with our boats. We had two swimmers that our Marine Patrol saved that were in distress, and I'm proud of my troops. They won life-saving awards through the Marine Board on this, but had we not been able to get there, there would have been a tragedy. And I've seen this time and time again. It doesn't happen every single day, but it does happen. So maintaining some type of a navigable channel, to me, is paramount to keeping the safety and security of our boaters and our recreational users out there on the river, whether they be paddlers or power boaters. We need to be out there to educate, to be visible, and to protect when they need our services.
Great. Thank you both for being here. Let me see if there's any questions.
I have one. Yeah. I do run the river. I'm a fisherman, and we bass fish a lot on the Willamette, and it's, you know, I can go up the Yamhill River comfortably. After that, it's a nervous wreck. The river does need to be maintained. It needs to be cleaned out. As far as the Wheatland Ferry, there's a gravel, quality concrete is right there, and that gravel could be turned over to them. It seems to be pretty realistic that it would be easy, and it would open up a tremendous recreational area for boats to go from Newburgh, from Canby, all the way to Salem and on to Albany. And it would be, that's a wonderful river trip because it's a beautiful river. Maybe the chair can explain to me why we can't
actually
do this.
We have somebody from the Department of State Lands that is going to come up and talk about it, but we'll see if there's any other questions for either of these witnesses.
We were told, by the way, Mrs. George, not to give you any grief.
Oh. Tell that person thank you.
I wonder who that could be. Thank you very much
thank
for coming here
much.
Today. We very much appreciate it.
And that's very hard for Senator Olson not to do that.
Yeah, we have somebody. I asked the director of the Department of State Lands, who will come up and provide a little bit of history, because this issue has been around for many, many years.
Okay, thank you again. And we told the captain we were going to make him wait till last but Captain Chesborough, and how many of you have been on his, for the record, I'm Liz Van Leeuwen.
We are often there with our bikes, just so you know.
Okay. He is probably the most knowledgeable person about the condition of the river of any of us, I believe. He's been accused of being that way because of selfish interests, but his boat used to be closer to me. I shouldn't call it a boat, should I? Closer to me when it was at Albany, and he had to move it this way. But let's let him go ahead quickly, and I've got a few things I'd like to close with. Unless Senator Boquist gets his body back.
He's actually
here.
Ill. He had to go home, we found out. He has walking pneumonia.
Oh, no.
That's what
this
place will do to you sometimes. So his apologies that he couldn't be here, but he had to go home ill. But thank you. And can you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Captain Richard Chesborough. I live in West Salem. And Liz is correct. I've been on the river for 12 years now and probably spend more time on the water simply because of our commercial operation. And have been very close to the issues that we're speaking about today. In fact, these charts that are in front of you were prepared by myself. I worked with Senator Boquist in doing some very extensive and exhaustive surveys of all the studies that have been done about the river. And this river has been studied to death over the years, as I'm sure you all are quite well aware. I would like to address primarily the navigation issues. Of late, we've heard from Senator Peter Courtney about the possibility of a major earthquake in the Mid-Valley and what the impact might be. I was approached by the State Police Department to make our vessel available in case of such an event to transport people up and down the river. And I had to tell them that there's a very good chance I would not be able to help simply because the river's not navigable. I'm getting a lot of pressure right now from the U.S. Coast Guard to remove our vessel from Salem and to take it downriver because the Coast Guard feels the mid and upper Willamette River is non-navigable, which would change a lot of legislation pertaining to the federal government and their interest in the Willamette River. But I have to agree with them because I've had three groundings in the last 2 years, which is unbelievable to me. And but the Coast Guard is pretty much fed up with it now, and they say that I'm putting passengers at risk. Not that they're at risk, because obviously if you're sitting on the bottom, there's not much that's going to happen except you get stuck. And but every year, this river brings 6 million tons of new gravel downstream with it and deposits it in places that are unbelievable. My most recent grounding, I'm embarrassed to say, was less than a quarter of a mile from downtown Salem. But lo and behold, we have a new island right out in the middle of the river now, just below the Willamette University shell barn, and that didn't exist last fall. And sure enough, I discovered it quite by accident and got stuck on it. Again, no damage to the boat, no damage to any people or anything else, but it was embarrassing. And this is unfortunately something that's experienced by a lot of boaters all the time. I work closely with the State Marine Board, and I watch their three-year, what they call their triannual studies of boat usage on the river. And in the 12 years that I've been on the river, I've seen it drop substantially. There were 16,000 registered boat owners just in Polk and Marion County on both sides of the river, and yet we had last triennium less than 165 boat use days all summer long. Pathetic. People buy boats and hoping to enjoy them and recreate with them, and the only way they can do that is to drive 100 miles round trip to Detroit Lake and try to recreate up on one of the reservoirs when we have this beautiful river, as you know, right in our backyard. I love our trip downstream when we go to dry dock, but you talk about pressure. It's a lot of stress simply because even in the high water time of the year, our vessel, which only draws 3 feet of water, comes within a foot of the bottom in numerous places just between Salem and the Newburgh Pool area. There's lots of reasons down here to consider why the Willamette River needs to be maintained. But navigation to me is one of the biggest ones. And if we had a navigable river, then we would have something that would always work in the event of a major earthquake, just as it did back in the 1800s and early 1900s. I remember when Senator Tom McCall rode on the tugboat that gave us the push up the river, all the way from Corvallis to Newburgh on a tugboat that drew 5 feet of water, and he and his whole party just had a wonderful trip downriver. And that wasn't that many years ago.
I've seen the pictures.
You've seen the pictures.
Yes, I've seen the pictures. And I should correct, we've actually put our bikes on the Wheatland Ferry, not on your boat, but I've been on your boat.
Been on the boat.
Thank you.
Been on the boat.
Well, we love being here in Salem. This has been our home, and I don't like the possibility of having to leave, but I may not in the very near future have any choice in the matter, simply because the river's just not safe for us anymore. That's why I had to leave Albany in the first place, is because the dock there at Monteith Park silted in because of the gravel bar right there, and suddenly the dock was of no use to anybody. And so they've now removed the dock. I've seen six boat ramps fall into disuse now, and the one that's right behind it that is very close to going into disuse is right here in downtown Salem at Wallace Marine Park. It's just washing away. And we as boaters pay attention to these things, and we've got lots of pictures to show. I've run the entire river in a drift boat, taken lots of photos of the erosion and the farmland where you can see the irrigation pipes hanging out over the banks where all the land has been washed into the river. And it's just a darn shame. We need to pay attention to what's going on with the river.
Well, thank you for being here today. Liz, did you want to say a few concluding words?
Just a few words, and you've got a packet of material and these pictures, and I know I should give them to you first.
Well, go ahead and give them to Erica.
One copy
okay.
of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which shows part of that, and I wish I had the one of somebody's irrigation well that's now way out in the river. You have in your hand, I think, okay, you have in your hand the that was prepared for when it was the Senate Bill 501. I trust that you will read that. It really addresses the issues, repeats part of what he said. One of the main purposes in this bill is nearly every approach to almost every dock along the Willamette River, even going down to Senator Prozanski's area, is blocked by aggregate. The city of Harrisburg, which is closer to me, has had the money from the Marine Board to open up their area, and they get it almost done, ready to do it, and one of the many agencies that's in charge blocks it for them. Those of us who farm could go in there with a piece of equipment and do what needs to be done, but that's not the way things happen anymore. But the Harrisburg Fire Department, who goes out to rescue and distress calls on the river, like he mentioned, they have to go several miles downstream to one of the few areas where they can launch their boats, which makes it extremely a long time before they can go help whoever might be in distress. Anyway, the bill was aimed at trying to get state parks to be interested in what we are doing and try to get some help so that people could use this as a recreation source. People want to go to water. He said nearly all of the reasons. You also have, and I kind of cut an email and put the name of Doug Henry, who wrote something as a retired school teacher and how he looks at this, and then the series of pictures that you have that look like this, I'm sorry they aren't identified, those came from Senator Boquist. I can tell you that this one is at Albany, and the colored pictures that you have that look like this, all up and down the river, at least from, well, up his way from Harrisburg, clear down through the Linn County, Benton County, Polk County, Yamhill area, you have all of this huge high bank erosion. It's utterly shocking how much erosion is there. The one that has the picture that has the trees and shows the erosion is close to the city of Harrisburg's affluent plant, and I believe they lost some 2 years ago, lost about 60 feet of bank to the river. I mean, it really needs to be addressed. And then the Democrat Herald newspaper, about the time, I can't remember what went on, but put in an editorial that I hope you will read, because if something should happen to us where we lose our bridges or roads, maybe the Willamette should be able to transport some things, and I'm not talking about from bank to bank, but at least a navigable channel that could be used for transportation. And I think I heard somebody in one of the bills that you heard earlier talking about barging gravel. No, the Willamette, at least on my end, is not gravel deficient, even though there may be some professors around at some of the universities who would tell you that. I would invite you to come out. I have one son who flies and one farmer son who runs a boat, and I'll gladly take you and show you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate it. I do have Luis Soliday is going to come up and provide a brief history because we're going to start to lose members. But thank you very much for being here, and we appreciate
you
bringing this forward.
For arranging this.
And Director Soliday, if you have a little bit of history on this, and I had asked the director to come up and provide some history about this issue and what's happening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Luis Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. I have too much history on this issue, unfortunately. But just a little history on dredging of the Willamette River Navigation Channel. Until about the mid-1970s, this section of the river was dredged periodically by the Corps of Engineers to maintain a navigation channel, and that's because it supported quite a bit of commerce back in the early 1900s and even up until after World War II. As the commercial use of the river waned, the Corps of Engineers halted dredging, and the reason for that is they have to do a cost-benefit analysis to justify their projects to Congress in order to get funding. And as they did the cost-benefit analysis was going down each year as less commerce was going on in the river, ultimately they abandoned trying to get funding because they couldn't justify it under the cost-benefit analysis that they have to do. Some folks who are now part of the Willamette River Channel Maintenance Group and I met back when I was working for Governor Kitzhaber in his first administration back in the late 1990s to talk about this issue. I actually went out and visited Lambert Bend, I think with Commissioner George and some other folks at one point to look at that particular situation and have actually been on the Willamette Queen on occasion and so have been out on the river and actually seen the issue. And I think it's important to remember this is a big river system. It is a very dynamic system, and it has high energy, and when we have big storm events, it moves a lot of material, and the river rearranges itself almost after every storm, and certainly every year things change. And it's done that through its history, so that's not something new. What is new is that since the mid-1970s, the Corps has not been dredging the navigation channel. Today, in order to do a project that would involve dredging a considerable, and I might mention the Willamette River is navigable for tidal purposes, so the state owns the beds and banks of the river, and as such, any dredging that occurs that results in gravel extraction that leads to the sale of commercial gravel would result in a royalty to my agency, which goes into the Common School Fund. It's a way we get revenue into the Common School Fund off of our waterways. But doing that has become more and more difficult, particularly with the listing of both Chinook salmon and steelhead on the Willamette River. We are facing this issue not just in the Willamette River, but also in several other rivers, particularly coastal rivers, which tend to be even more dynamic and move much greater volumes of material for the size of the river systems on the coast. We have been in a long discussion with the Corps of Engineers and the National Marine Fisheries Service and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about how we keep our existing gravel operations in the water and operating. And for the gravel operators that we permit are mostly working on dry gravel bars in the summertime, so they're not in the water itself. We do have sand extraction that goes on in the Columbia River, but the gravel extraction operations that we have on the coast are dry gravel bar operations during the in-water work period, and they're not actually working in the water. They're working on those gravel bars. And even keeping those folks operating has been difficult under the Endangered Species Act requirements. The Willamette River is also would be an expensive river if somebody was going to come in and decide, well, we're going to maintain this channel again. It would be a several million dollar project to do that. You're talking about probably 100 miles of river if you go from the Willamette Falls up to Albany or Corvallis or even further up. You're talking about considerable amount of dredging that would occur. Whether commercial gravel operators could get permit it to do it and do it as a commercial operation, I think, is a question mark. And again, if it wasn't being done as a commercial operation, I think someone trying to come in to get permits to do this would have to have a large sum of money in order to get through the permitting process. And at the end of the day, I'm not sure they would get through the federal process with the 404 permit requirements and the Endangered Species Act requirements. So I think we're sitting with a difficult situation for the folks who want to recreate on the river. We've got fish issues with the fish that are listed on the Endangered Species Act who do use that corridor for migration. And in some cases, the off-channel areas in this area, the river for both spawning and rearing. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. All right. We'll take a couple of questions, and then we're going to wrap up.
Of course, I got questions.
Senator Olson.
Does Wilsonville Concrete still mine aggregate out of the river? Close to
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I believe so. We do have some operations on the Willamette.
If it was possible, we're talking millions of tons of material. And I personally buy that material, and I know it's expensive. And it probably would be extremely profitable, and it would certainly assist our state in jobs. It would certainly assist our state in Common School Fund. More importantly, the thing that I'm concerned about, as this river fills up, when we have these flood events, there's not enough room to contain the water that comes down, which means that it's going to go into valuable farmland if we don't keep these rivers a little bit deeper than they're as they should be. I think that this would be a great work group for the summertime, so we could kayak the river and see what kind of... No, honestly, this is something that we really have to work on. And you know, we just passed to the floor a bill that allows you guys and Dugami to work together. And I know it's going to be...
We didn't pass it yet.
Well, we haven't passed it yet, but we passed it to the floor. It's going to be an important issue. Oh, that's right, we didn't, did we? It's going to be an important issue to work this river because, I mean, this was a navigable, workable river for many, many years. And to let the federal government just let it dry up on us before long, we're just going to have a mud puddle. And floods are going to be a problem. We can use commerce on there. This is a gold mine that we should be looking at, seriously.
Any comments before we wrap up?
Madam Chair, from the DSL, it's interesting. I wear two hats when it comes to the Willamette. We are the proprietor of the beds and banks, and we regulate the activities that go on within those beds and banks. And from a proprietary perspective, it would be great to have the royalties that would come in from commercial operations that might extract gravel. On a regulatory side, I'm well aware of the regulatory hurdles that are in place with the state permitting, the federal permitting, and the ESA consultation that would have to happen.
Right, any other questions before we wrap up? All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming here today. Louise, thank you for staying to provide us with that history. And I'm sure, Senator Olson, if you want to follow up, Senator, with that, Louise, she'd be happy to
provide you with
lots more information. With that, we're going to close the informational meeting on the Willamette River Channel Maintenance, and we are adjourned until Thursday.
I'm going to go talk to...